Okay, so I'll go get started. So we end more or less on time. My name's Chris Clayton. I finished my PhD in 2020, and Emmanuel was one of my committee co-chairs. So it's really wonderful to be here today presenting this work, especially since it very much connects to Emmanuel's work, including with Matteo on the international monetary system. It's also really nice, you know, we're going to, the theory here today is going to be a lot about dynamic reputation, and Emmanuel was also one of the people who first taught me about that type of modeling. So I'm very happy to be able to bring techniques that he taught to me into topics that were of interest to him. Okay, and I should just say that this is joint work with Amanda, who's here today, as well as with Matteo and Jesse, who unfortunately couldn't be here today. So the starting point for this paper is going to be a question of kind of how do international currencies develop as kind of dominant currencies. And we're going to be looking at it through the lens, as opposed to the US, as is often done. Here we're going to be looking at through the lens of China. Why are we looking at through the lens of China? It's because we've seen, well, China's a giant bond market, third largest in the world, behind only US and consolidated EU area. And part of its stated goal is to become an international currency similar to the dollar. So what has been interesting about China is that until the last decade or so, its bond market has been largely closed off to foreign investors. And that liberalization process has been happening fairly rapidly over the last 10 years. And we're going to argue today that this liberalization strategy connects in very cleanly with this idea of developing to be a kind of competitor as a global reserve currency or global store of value. The key challenge that we're going to think about today is how do you build yourself up as an international store of value in a world where foreigners might be worried that ex post you're going to do something to take their money from them. For example, imposing outflows restrictions at the time that foreigners are trying to get their money out. So in particular, what are we going to do today? So I'm going to start quickly by going through three stylized facts we document about the liberalization process of China's bond market, and then spend most of the talk today on the theory. So the first stylized fact I'll show you is a rapid rise in foreign RMB-denominated investment. And the interesting thing about this rise in investment is going to be that it came first predominantly from kind of stable official holders like central banks or private agents like pension funds. And then only in the recent couple years has come from kind of what you might think of as flightier private agents such as mutual funds. We'll also, our second stylized fact will be that this kind of staggered entry approach to liberalization was a deliberate policy choice of the Chinese government around a series of access programs over the last two decades. And the third stylized fact will be that by the time the kind of flightier investors are entering, they're holding RMB bonds, RMB denominated bonds, as part of portfolios that mix DM and EM currency bonds. So it looks like they're being treated kind of somewhere as a mixture of DM and EM from kind of a risk perspective. Then what we're going to do is embed, which will be most of today, is building a dynamic theory of reputation building to become a global safe asset provider. The basic idea of the model is going to be we've got investors who face a government that can be committed or opportunistic, and they're going to be worried that the opportunistic government is going to impose ex post capital controls and lock their money into the country. At low reputational levels, it's going to be optimal for the government to only borrow from stable investors, and then as its reputation builds up, it's going to endogenously open up to the flightier investors. What's going to be, there's going to be a few kind of particularly interesting things about what this model is going to tell us. One of the big things it's going to tell us is that there's actually a particularly large gain in reputation that happens as a result of the opening up process to flightier investors, precisely because opening up to flightier investors is a particularly costly action for the opportunistic government to take relative to the committed government. And one of the big extensions that we're really excited about that I'll talk a little bit about today is studying reserve currency competition, or kind of competition between safe asset providers. So let me just highlight two quick pieces of literature that we closely connect to. The first, of course, is Emmanuel's work with Matteo on the International Monetary System, which our kind of core model is very much going to be building off of. The other, of course, is Phelan, 2006, as well as Manuel's work with Chris Phelan in recent years on dynamic reputation building. We're very much going to be building off of this literature. So let me start by just spending a couple minutes going through the stylized facts and then get to the model. So the first, this is just an aggregate graph of the rise in foreign participation in China's bond market. It's increased over the last 10 years from like 100 billion to more like 600 billion. And what's particularly interesting here is to look at the breakdown of how this rise happened. In particular, when we break it down, what do we see in 2014, 15, 16, even out a little bit more? Essentially, all of this was coming from reserve investment, and very little was coming from the private sector. And it's only really by 2019 and 2020 that we see a big acceleration in private sector inflows into Chinese bond markets. It's also worth just mentioning here, essentially the entirety of, or the vast majority of what these foreign investors of all types are buying are government bonds and policy bank bonds, and very little of it is going into kind of privates, to the corporates. So let me not give too much of a detail of Chinese financial history. Let me just give a very brief overview. So what's the kind of, 30,000 foot overview? What happened early stage with QFII? What do we see? We see kind of very kind of limited access into the bond market. You have to come actually open up onshore. You can trade stocks, but you can only trade exchange bonds, which is a small part of the market. By kind of 2010 to 2015 period, the market started to open up a little bit more with QFII, RQFII2, as well as with CIBM, which allowed for broader access without restrictions like quotas for direct long-term investors like central banks and sovereign wealth funds. And when the market really opened up for kind of private flows was in 2017 with the introduction of the Bond Connect program, which allowed offshore access to the onshore market through Hong Kong to international investors. And it paved the way for kind of global index inclusion. So what do we show here? This is just kind of the CDF of entry of different investors through the approval process of these programs. What do we see? We see that stable investors enter kind of quickly following the introduction of the programs in the early mid-2010s. Flighty investors enter really starting later in the process around the introduction of Bond Connect and global index inclusion. So third stylized facts is just, let's look at kind of what, let's get a sense of how foreign investors are treating these bonds when they start buying them. And what we're going to look at here is a little bit of portfolio evidence from mutual funds and Morningstar. And what we're going to do is a simple exercise of just, let's take the share of the portfolio that a mutual fund holds in a currency's bond, say China, and then take the share that that fund holds in DM currency bonds in the rest of their portfolio and correlate the two of them. So if we find a correlation of one, that means that as I increase my holdings of Chinese bonds, I tend to be holding more DM bonds in the rest of my portfolio. What do we see when we do this out? We see, well, at the far left, US dollar highly correlated with the rest of the portfolio being in DM bonds. We go all the way over to the rupiah. What do we see? We see very negative correlation of investment in the rupiah with DM bonds. What do we see right in the middle? China with essentially zero correlation between investment into China and investment into DM bonds. So it's just an interesting perspective that right now, over the whole sample, China's sort of in the middle, right between DM and EM. Another interesting, oh, sorry.
That's based on which data set for investors?
Morningstar mutual funds. So same data set now. All we do is we say, let's look at within fund shifts in 2019 and 2020. What do we see? So this is just asking, suppose a fund shifts into China, what do they shift out of? We see overwhelmingly their shift within fund, they're shifting out of DM bonds. So now let me take these three facts and spend the rest of the talk. So the kind of three facts are, one, kind of staggered entry, stable then flighty; two, deliberate policy choice of the Chinese government; three, by the time opened up, it was sort of looking like a mixture between a DM and an EM from a bond perspective. And now we're going to build a dynamic reputation model in order to both kind of understand these facts, think about the problem that the kind of decision problem China is undertaking here, as well as to use it to think about issues like how to think about competition between international reserve currencies. Gita, please.
Before thinking of this in terms of a reputation model, suppose you just think of this as China now entering a new market and wants to do it cautiously, right? So it's opening up, things can go wrong, so it's going to start with the safe guys and then move into the more riskier class. That's not about reputation.
So it's not, you know, so part of the, so it's like, it's sort of a question of like, is it investors learning about China, or is it China learning about investors? You know, the reason we're focusing on it as investors learning about China, which is sort of the reputation framework, is at least in principle, China could potentially learn a lot from other countries' experiences by looking, say, you know, at their experiences with different types of institutions, at their experiences opening up to different capital flows, and learn from that. Whereas, you know, the Chinese government may be a kind of maybe harder for investors to directly learn about. So that's why we're thinking about it in this way. But I agree, that's another model that might also help to explain the facts.
Just to follow up on that, I mean, the fact that a biggest right of the flighty investors comes when essentially the enter the indices. To make that argument more forcefully that it's not mechanical because they enter the indices, a bunch of asset managers started investing, you might want to clean the demand and plot just the demand, which is not through index investing, and plot that. Right? And then it's not mechanical for me, but
That's a great suggestion. We should do that and see how much of it is coming from the index, just pure index. So I know we've studied and there's definitely a big index inclusion effect. We should decompose out how much is coming from that and how much is coming otherwise.
Or use other investors, and Morningstar is going to be a very select set. There are going to be, you know, like hedge funds, institutional investors in China. I mean, the correlation might be completely different. I mean, the best will be the universe of investors, then you can get rid of indexing. Plus, you are not going to be, you know, buying by select sample.
I mean, it is, you know, there's definitely, you know, there's reasons to expect, of course, it might be a select sample going in at first, if it's like, you know, specialists going into the market, but completely agree, we'll think about that. Okay, so what are we gonna do? We're gonna develop a sub-game about raising funds, and then we're gonna embed it into our dynamic reputation model. So the structure of this model is going to be, there's an infinite horizon, discrete time, where each state T is going to have a borrowing investment subgame, which is going to kind of be the founding block for the reputation process. It's going to be a large economy in the sense that it's going to internalize the effects of its issuance on its price of borrowing. And this is going to be the source of value of building up reputation, is essentially building up its monopoly power. The government here is going to be committed or opportunistic. Let me just describe the timeline quickly before describing that difference. So here, in each subgame, or at each date, the subgame is going to have a beginning, middle, and end. At the beginning, we're going to raise debt to finance long-term investment in the economy. In the middle of the period, there can be a crisis, at which point there may be outflows from the country. At this point, the opportunistic government is going to be tempted to impose an ex post capital control and limit outflows, whereas the committed government would never even dream of imposing an ex post capital control. And this is going to be the source for the building process of reputation. Then at the end of the subgame, payoffs are going to be distributed. You'll carry on to the next period. The only state variable that's going to be carried between dates is the reputation of the country, which we'll define in a couple slides. So the kind of investment part of the subgame is going to look a lot like, Manuel, please. So they end at the end of the subgame, exactly. So the short-term debt is due in the middle of the subgame. The long-term assets mature at the end of the subgame. So
there is no reserve.
Sorry?
The country doesn't have any reserves that you could use in case of capital
flight. No. So there's not going to be like, it's all going to be, it's going to be fully invested. We're not going to have anything like, you know, or we're not going to have like bailouts. You can't step in to prop up the economy. Nothing like that. Not yet, at least. But it's something we will think about for, we want to think about for extensions. So intermediation subgame looks very familiar from a macro finance perspective. What do we have? Long-term investment financed with inside equity raised from domestics, as well as foreign debt at a endogenous interest rate. Interest rate determination on the next slide. What happens in the investment phase? The project grows according to a quality adjustment. If you chop it down in the middle of the period, you have a liquidation discount. What happens? So here we're going to focus only on the case where crises occur every date. In the paper, we also allow for a high state in the middle of the period where a crisis doesn't occur. But to simplify exposition, I'm going to suppress that for today's talk. So middle of the period, you roll over debt subject to a collateral constraint. Here's where the temptation to impose capital controls on outflows comes in. Because what do you do by imposing a control on outflow? You limit capital flight from the country. Here, HT is going to be the haircut. That's going to be the key difference in our model between stable and flighty investors on the next slide. And tau is the capital control tax. What is this bias? This buys us that the value function in the subgame of the government is just going to be a net worth multiplier, which depends on the haircut as well as on the capital control tax, times the liquidation value of the inside equity of the bank. Importantly, of course, the net worth multiplier falls in the haircut, rises in the capital control tax. So, please, you're...
What do you have in mind for the macro foundation of this constraint? It's not like if China defaults, they can actually seize anything inside China. So
this is like, this isn't like a default, really. It's like we are imposing a tax on outflows. So it's saying, like, you can take your money out of the country, but you have to pay us a tax to take it. So it's more like a maturity lengthening than an outright default.
But still, why is that related to the whatever you think about as the liquidation value of whatever you think of the long-term project?
You mean, why is it the interest rate, you mean?
No, no, why does the constraint look like this?
Because it affects the borrowing rate in, so you put a wedge, the control tax puts a wedge between the foreign borrowing rate and the domestic borrowing rate, and you roll.
The question is, why do you tie it to the liquidation value? Well, what do you think of as the liquidation value? Because you're not really going to liquidate anything in that time.
But the domestic people can. The domestic people can actually notice it, and then you're saying the wedge.
Exactly. We're thinking of this as basically, you know, the foreigners sell it to the domestic sees it, that gives you your liquidation discount. So stable, so this is our, you know, this is what our debt issuing government is going to be looking to maximize in the subgame. So what's the key second part of this model? It's the interest rate determination. We've got our stable and flighty investors. They have the same demand schedules in the sense that they kind of both, they're willing to supply debt to the country. They've got a outside option, a common outside option R that they could alternatively deploy funds to. And they've got a holding cost DT squared for holding Chinese debt. This is just kind of our stand-in for forces like risk aversion, which is the way that we get a upward sloping demand curve, or an upward sloping price in the debt issuance of the country. What's the key difference between them? It's the difference in the haircuts. Flightier investors are going to demand a larger haircut on the debt than stable investors will. What'll that do? That'll force more project liquidations when you end up in the crisis. All investors have to be treated pari passu, so you have to give them the same terms on both dimensions of the contract, both the interest rate and the haircut. So what do we get out of that? We get out the demand curve. The interest rate is upward sloping in the amount of debt issuance. What's this M object? It's the probability that capital controls are not imposed, and we're going to call that the reputation of the country. Note that this is going to be distinct, although of course tied to, the probability that the government is the committed. So let me just show you a visualization of the optimal policy, of the optimal debt policy of the committed type here. I can show you the equations which say the same thing. So let me show graphs. So what do we have? We have a threshold reputation level, M star, which is the opening up reputation, where when your country's reputation is below that point, the committed government only borrows from stable investors, borrows at a relatively low issuance. And then once it passes M star, the kind of the buildup in reputation and the desired issuance strategy of the committed government exceeds the cost of extending the contract to the flightier investors and accepting the larger haircut on collateral. So what happens at that point? The country opens up. It has a big increase in its debt issuance policy because now it's also borrowing from the flighty investors, and the slope of its additional borrowing doubles as it's now borrowing from both types at the same time. On the other hand, there's no corresponding jump in the interest rate here simply because you hadn't been moving up one of the two investors' demand curves, and now you're moving up the other investor's demand curve. So what do we get out of all this? So what we get out of all this, in addition to our policy functions, debt and the interest rate and the kind of M-star decision, we also get out clean indirect utility functions from the sub-game that we can then take and feed into the dynamic reputation. So in particular, let's take the indirect utility function from the sub-game of the committed government, where here it's defined over their reputation levels. Then what do we have? Because we have a network multiplier, which depends on the capital control tax, then the indirect utility that the opportunistic type gets from deviating and imposing the capital control ex post is just a multiplier of the indirect utility of the committed type. And the fact that it's just a constant multiplier, which depends on the haircut, which is something that I'll talk about as we get through it, is what's going to make this tractable in the dynamic model. So, okay, so now we're out of the sub game and we're into the dynamic game. So now that we're into the dynamic game, we need to define in a bit more detail, how the beliefs of investors evolve over these types. So here we're very much following Phelan and Amador Phelan. We'll have a government type that's following a Markov process. So each period, committed types and opportunistic types can die and be replaced by the opposite type government. What's this going to generate? It's going to generate mixed strategy equilibrium. A mixed strategy equilibrium. How are investors going to update their beliefs about whether or not the government's the committed type? We just have the beliefs are based on how many types are either committed or pretending to be committed versus how many types are actually committed. What's the reputation of the country? It's just how many types are committed plus how many types are opportunistic and are pretending to be committed. So, okay, what's the solution concept here? It's gonna have a graduation date. How does it look? It's going to be an equilibrium cycle between 2+1 dates, where there's an interior point of the cycle, T star, which is the point in the cycle at which the government first opens up to the flighty investors. So before T star, you're only letting in stable guys. After T star, you're also letting in flighty guys. And then the graduation date T is going to be the date such that before then, opportunistic types are playing mixed strategies on the capital control. And of course, after date T, the opportunistic type deviates with probability one. Of course, there's no, T star doesn't have to be interior, of course. For today's talk, we're gonna focus only on cases where it's interior. So what's the evolution process here? So the objective function of the opportunistic government, if it doesn't impose capital controls, it gets the indirect utility from the subgame of the committed government, V, and it continues on and builds up its reputation. What happens if, rather than pretending to be committed and not imposing the capital control, It imposes the capital control, then its value is, it gets a high flow value from imposing the capital control, but it loses its reputation and resets to the beginning of the cycle. And this, of course, is where we're very much building on kind of Phelan, Amador Phelan, where what happens if you reset? You don't reset to zero, you reset to something bigger than zero because of the possibility of type switching. So what's the value function of the opportunistic government? It's just the max between imposing and not imposing capital controls in order to be willing to mix at a date. That means the value of the two has to be equal. That's our indifference condition. In order to be willing to graduate at the graduation date, the value from imposing the capital control has to be weakly higher than not imposing the capital control. So now what we can do is we can take this and let me sketch out how we can actually solve this model. So the way we can actually solve this model is essentially start from kind of an initial reputational level. We can always get the value function at that initial level because we know at that point we have to be indifferent. So it's just the value of imposing capital controls forever and staying at the beginning of the cycle. And then we have the reputational buildup process. What's the reputational buildup process? It's just saying, how much utility do we have to promise to the opportunistic type at the next step of the cycle in order to get them to be willing to pretend to be committed and not impose the capital control? What the kind of structure of the indirect utility function here really, Manuel, please. Sorry?
What is G
of H? That is the proportional value of imposing the capital control versus not imposing the capital. So we have basically the value function was a net worth multiplier times the liquidation value of the bank. So G is the ratio between that net worth multiplier if you impose the control and the net worth multiplier if you don't impose the control. So it's something that's always greater than one. And it's also something that declines in the haircut. So when the haircut is higher, the relative net worth multiplier falls, and that's going to be important on the next slide. So what do we get now? So we have an AR1 process with time-varying coefficients. What are these time-varying coefficients depend on? They depend on which stage of the reputational evolution process you're in. So if you're in the early stage, then you're only open to stable investors and you're evolving according to kind of a simple AR1 equation where the slope of the process is the slope of reputation buildup. For example, you build up reputation more quickly if, say, the discount rate is higher or if, say, the value of imposing capital controls is relatively higher. Then what happens is you hit the point of opening up and you have two costs associated with moving to the next step of the cycle. So the first cost is kind of the usual cost, which is you need to be promised higher value tomorrow to be willing to defer from today. So that's just the usual. But then when you open up, you also have a second cost, which is a change in the relative benefit you get from imposing capital controls. So what does this do? This gives a jump in the evolution dynamics of indirect utility at the point of opening up, where you get a particularly large increase in reputation at that point, because in the process of opening up to the flighty investors, you've foregone some of the efficacy of your capital control measures. So this is kind of one of the interesting features of the model that we want to highlight here, which is the idea that opening up is sort of a particularly costly and particularly reputation building action for a country. So just two quick results here. Prop one, Suppose that there's only the flighty investors, or equivalently, both investors have the same haircut, then there's a unique equilibrium of this form. Proposition two, right now what we can show is that there's unique, there's at most one conditional on an opening update. I won't go into detail today why it's at most one here. So let me illustrate kind of the dynamics of reputation building here, and then conclude with saying a couple things about reserve currency competition. So this is just kind of a an illustration of the dynamics of the model, not like a serious, not a serious calibration. So what happens here? So we start in the beginning of the reputation cycle at a low reputation level, where debt issuance is relatively low and the equilibrium borrowing rate is high. What happens then? We start building up reputation as a country, but we haven't built up enough reputation yet that we're actually willing up to open up to the flighty investors. What happens at this point? At this point, the next step in the reputational building process pushes us above this threshold reputational level for opening up. So what happens at this point? At this point, the country opens up, it lets in the flighty investors, it suffers that loss to the opportunistic government from losing some of the efficacy of its capital control measure. And as a result, of the increase in reputation and the opening up to the flighty investors, we see a particularly large increase in debt issuance at that point, and a kind of less stark drop in the interest rate at that point due to the particularly large increase in debt issuance. What happens after that? At that point, the dynamic process starts to slow down. Once you've got have a larger or once you have a smaller value from imposing the capital control tax, the coefficient of the AR1 process falls and we get a slower convergence rate. And so from that point on, we converge more slowly over to graduation, at which point all opportunistic types are flushed out and reset to the beginning of the cycle, and only committed types continue on from there. You can also see here kind of, let me skip this in detail from the beginning of.
I had a question.
Yes.
Gita suggested another story. What, would there be kind of collateral predictions of one versus the other that would allow you to, did you think of other stories more generally and say, why you think your story has, you know, other, you know, some evidence or factual evidence that would go for it versus.
So that,
will you tell us something about this?
So we don't have evidence for that right now. That's very much something we're mindful of and interested in. The answer right now we have is purely kind of a, sort of we talked to a few people in industry, they've suggested this is a concern, but it's much more, anecdotal than we have, strong evidence in favor of this one. It's certainly something we can think about for future iterations of this project. So let me spend.
I've one thing that you could look at is the build-up of regulation in a kind of concurrent way to what you're saying. If you could
yes, it's a good suggestion. We'll look a little into that as well. Thank you very much. I have 5 minutes, Philippe?
Yeah, you have 5 minutes.
Okay, let me spend, so this is the basics of the model. This is sort of how we use it to, as one of the ways we can understand China's internationalization strategy. Let me spend the last 5 minutes just talking a little bit about how we can take this and use it to think about competition among reserve currency issuers, which we think is one of the exciting directions we're still in the process of going in this process. So this is preliminary. This is preliminary. So how are we going to think about this? So we're going to think about this as, like, you know, what if you have the US and China, or what if you have multiple possible reserve currency issuers? How does their competition with each other affect this dynamic process? So the way we're going to think about this is, previously we sort of, you know, previously it could have been a single country, or it could have been a kind of distribution of countries in the cycle, or a cross-section of countries in the cycle. It didn't really matter. Now we're going to kind of seriously say this is a cross-section, and we're going to think about the impacts of different elements of the cross-section on their impact on each other. So in particular, now we're going to open this up to heterogeneous investors. There's going to be a distribution over countries' reputations mu. This distribution is going to be endogenous to the reputation game. So this is an endogenous object of the problem. What's the kind of cost of an investor in this country is the same preferences as before. Value of returns relative to the outside option. The difference now is the holding costs are determined by the entire portfolio. So if I'm holding more of one country in the reputation cycle, it becomes more costly for me to hold countries at other points in the reputation cycle.
And you use the distribution over who?
It is the distribution over country reputations. So it's going to be a discrete distribution out of, so we specify it, you know, this, you could feed it, like, from an investor perspective, you could feed in any distribution, of course. The equilibrium distribution is going to be discrete.
How many countries are you
going to
have?
Measure one, all small. So what can we do out of this? So we've got multiple investors. Here we can show an aggregation result over those multiple investors. What can we do? We can basically add them up into a single demand curve, where that single demand curve is based on kind of the relative portfolio weights of all those different investors for a given reputation level. And it's also based on this object B star, which is our competition effect, which is essentially the holding cost from the entire cross-section of countries. So now what can we do here? The committed government debt policy now depends on this holding cost from all countries in the reputation game. Holding fixed a given B star, we get the same existence uniqueness as we did before. What can we then take? We know the stationary distribution is going to be a set of mass points in this economy. What do we know here? Basically, it's going to yield a consistency, or quote, market clearing condition, where the kind of debt issuance decisions that come out of this have to be consistent with the definition. So let me just say one last thing and then I'll conclude. So how does this affect the, so it affects the debt issuance process, but it also affects the buildup of the reputation process. In particular, what does more competition do? It forces a faster rate of reputation building. Why does it do that? Essentially, you're getting less value from a given reputation at any given point, so you have to build up reputation faster to be willing to continue onwards. And we have some preliminary results along the lines of committed types, say, being able to crowd out opportunists.
What would it be that in 2020 something happened that would make China accelerate, or would you explore that empirically?
So our best anecdote for that.
The euro comes, you know, something happened with the euro, and then China thinks that, you know, I'm facing more competition. Is there anything you could explore there empirically?
Well, So the two things we're exploring on that front, the first is we're exploring sort of the qualitative, or at least the 2015 kind of China episode, where you know, this sort of loose argument we formed there is what happened in 2015. China faced some turmoil. They did impose kind of outflow restrictions on domestic Chinese investors, but they didn't, to our knowledge, impose the same sets of restrictions on foreign investors. So that's our first, and you know, what immediately following that was Bond Connect. So that's kind of the first anecdotal evidence. We're currently thinking about anecdotal evidence on the competition side from kind of historical episodes, but that's not yet ready for me to say out loud. But we can talk for a few minutes after. So let me conclude here. So this is just connecting it to fact three, but I don't have time for that. So conclusion, we've proposed a few stylized facts about the kind of evolution of the Chinese bond markets, provided the dynamic reputation model to help try to understand the strategy China is pursuing. And you know, this is early on in the process, it's giving some interesting ideas to look at things like how do we think about competition between different reserve currency providers in this dynamic process. So thank you all very much. Sorry I went a couple minutes over.